My next guest is Douglas Rushkoff. Douglas recently penned a piece that I think you'll find more than interesting and not a little disturbing as well. The piece is titled Survival of the Richest, The Wealthy Are Plotting to Leave Us Behind, and it's in advance of his new book, Team Human. Douglas is professor of media theory and digital economics at CUNY Queens. Douglas Rushkoff, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you.
So I saw this article, and I would like you to begin by telling the story of your invite to a super deluxe private resort where you were asked to deliver what you thought was going to be a keynote speech, please.
Yeah, well, you know, and I get these all the time. I've written a bunch of books on media technology and culture, and, you know, a lot of times there'll be business people and bankers and marketers who want me to come and talk about, you know, the future of AI or the future of cloning or the future of Bitcoin. And I figured it was one of those. And it was weird, though. It was one of those resorts where you kind of get taken on a little golf cart out to a cabin, you know, and you stay in your own little cabin. And I mean, it was practically like they put a bag over my head before I came to this place. And then I finally got back on a little golf cart and they brought me to the place where my talk was going to be. And I'm sitting in the green room, you know, getting ready to go on. And instead of putting me on the stage, they brought five billionaires into the room. And they just sat around this little round table with me and started peppering me with all these questions about, you know, should they invest in Bitcoin or Ethereum or, you know, what strategy should they be using for their business? And then, you know, finally, they got around to their real question, which was, you know, should I build my bunker in Alaska or New Zealand? And that was the whole thing. I spent an hour talking with them about their doomsday scenarios and preparations.
Questions like, how do I maintain authority over my security force after the event? So my question is, wait, after the event, after what event?
Well, the event, whichever event that's going to end the world as we know it. You know, they're concerned about social unrest, climate change, a disease, a nanotech accident, nuclear war, electromagnetic pulse, economic collapse, whatever it is that makes the fabric of society break down and makes it so, you know, government can't protect people anymore, or everybody out in the world is dying. And, you know, the interesting thing is, you know, the real billionaires, the Elon Musks or Richard Branson, the big billionaires, they can get off. You know, they got rocket ships at this point. These are the mid-level billionaires who really are still worried about, how am I going to do this? So they're all, you know, buying land and trying to build these little eco farms that are somehow sustainable and defensible after the event. But they are concerned. I mean, the big problem they have is, how do they defend themselves when their money is not worth anything?
Yeah, so they're going to have armed guards. And so how do they pay the guards once money is worthless? How do they stop the guards from choosing their own leader? These are the questions that they're asking.
Right. And it's, in some ways, it's just a game. You know, it's a game that billionaires play. And even if it costs a few hundred million dollars of investment to game it out, you know, it makes them feel a little safer when they're sleeping at night, that they could hop in their helicopter if the news on CNN is bad and go to their, you know, secret hideout. Mm-hmm. But it also, it's really, to me, indicative of their picture of the world, you know, that these are guys who are really trying to earn enough money so they can insulate themselves from the reality they're creating by earning money in that way. You know, they feel really guilty and shameful, but also they're into self-preservation.
Well, you know, not every billionaire is like this. I mean, you have Warren Buffett and Bill Gates giving away, you know, the biggest majority of their vast fortunes to try to help humanity.
Right.
And they're not looking for ways to kind of escape and worry about, you know, how are they going to be able to survive. It's almost like one of those zombie movies or something like this, these apocalyptic movies. You know, it almost seems, in a sense, that they're wrapped up in this fantasy world.
Yeah. I mean, the question is whether it's a fantasy world or whether it's real. You know, are they finally coming to grips with the pain and devastation left in the wake of their industries? You know, are they becoming aware of the, you know, all the little fingers that are lost in the Chinese factories? Or are they aware of the boys that are sent into the mines in the Congo to get the rare earth metals for our smartphones? Are they aware of the collapse of cognition and even, you know, American children who are using iPhones or living in, you know, the Wi-Fi zones all day? I mean, as they become aware of that, they start to realize, oh, wow, we can't run away from the externalities of our businesses anymore. And I mean, the response of some of them, like you're saying, of a Buffett or a Gates, is to think, okay, we better quickly start pouring some of this money we took out of the system back into it, mm-hmm. into ways that are going to fix things. But the other guys are thinking, no, let me just spend what I have to get my own hide out of this mess.
Well, you mentioned this idea of change and the disruption of these industries, that they're changing forever, or that technology is changing. How is this any different than what we experienced during the Industrial Revolution, where all of the things, so many jobs were lost, so many things were changed, and actually conditions are just so much better today than they were for the people back then? I mean, child labor was ubiquitous back then and not even thought of as wrong, and so on. How is this different?
Well, I think what's different is back in those days, we were colonizing other people. You know, we were colonizing brown people in South Africa and Africa and in the Indies. And now we're colonizing ourselves. Mm. Now we're colonizing human attention. We're colonizing our own markets. You know, these companies are not invading foreign soil. They're invading our own schools, our own neighborhoods, our own water. So it's a little bit different. The world's gotten a bit smaller.
Yeah. You know, it wasn't always this way. I mean, there was a time when technology thought it was going to bring humanity up and to create a better world. You're saying that's changed, and if that has changed, when did it start to change?
I mean, I think the turning point was really when Wired magazine framed the internet as a business opportunity rather than an opportunity for humanity. You know, the stock market had been going down since the late 80s, had this big crash, and the biotech was looked at as the potential future of the market, and it had failed. And Wired said, don't worry, the internet can make the market do what it had failed to. Mm-hmm. They published a cover story in a book called The Long Boom, where they said, thanks to the internet, the economy will now grow on an accelerated basis, exponentially, forever. That yeah, was their thesis.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And to some extent, you know, it can, as long as you're willing to invest in, you know, companies like Facebook or Google and try to figure out how they can, you know, grow exponentially forever. But there's a cost to that. So I feel like that was the turning point, really, in the early 90s, when the internet went from being this kind of weird academic experiment in what are the possibilities of the collective human imagination, to more the question of, you know, how much money can we extract from people and places using these new digital technologies?
It also seems to reduce the human being to a series of zeros and ones. And therefore, since human beings are much more complicated than any kind of written algorithm that can be produced, then somehow humans become flawed. And since those flaws can't actually be corrected, the idea would be to change humans through smart drugs or implants and things of that nature.
Yeah. I mean, you know, if you look at human beings as the problem and technology is the solution, then you end up wanting to use technologies to try to optimize human beings to the needs of this growth-based marketplace. And you start buying this really kind of bastardized understanding of Darwin. I mean, he never really talked about survival of the fittest individual. What Darwin was arguing for was this understanding of evolution as this collaboration between species. That's what he kept marveling at the way different species would collaborate and cooperate in order to ensure mutual survival. But if instead we take this kind of market view of humanity, that human beings are only valuable insofar as they can contribute to the growth of this marketplace, you know, then we all lose, because there's a certain point at which, if human beings are here to help the marketplace grow, then the cart and the horse are reversed. The market was supposed to help human beings get what they needed. It's not that human beings are here to serve that market.
My guest is Douglas Rushkoff, professor of media theory and digital economics at CUNY Queens, and his new book, Team Human, speaks a lot to what we're talking about today. The piece that I read was The Survival of the Richest, the Wealthy Are Plotting to Leave Us Behind. So you've been talking about these issues now for some time. And how are you now perceived? I guess there's kind of a groupthink that goes on in the technology world, that they're changing the world and they're kind of on the side of good and which is being rewarded through all these wonderful riches. How is someone who's standing there going, no, I don't see it this way? How are you being treated?
I mean, I'm being treated pretty well on a certain level. They agree that what they're doing is not good, most of them. You know, a lot of them who've been through, you know, the computer program at Stanford, they took specific classes in how to manipulate people. You know, there's a department there called captology, which is about how to use behavioral economic tricks through technology to get people to do stuff,
yeah,
to addict kids to social media or make people feel bad if they don't check their Facebook every day, all the little tricks of the trade. And the people who were really the best at that have kind of seen the error of their ways, at least halfway. And now they do want to change things. So they're talking about, you know, how can we be more humane? How can we develop what they call more humane technology? So that's sort of technology that treats people better. But, you know, when I keep hearing the phrase humane technology, I think of cage-free chickens, you know, that they're going to develop technology that treats people better all the way to the slaughter.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know the veracity of this, but, you know, I've read that people in Silicon Valley, many of them, are reducing the amount of technological exposure their own children have because they're seeing the damage there. Is that something you're seeing?
Yeah. I mean, but most of the people I know in the industry, they make stuff for our kids, but they don't let their own kids use it.
Yeah.
You know, they'll make, you know, the smart boards and iPad programs for the kids to use in public schools, and they'll do sales pitches and TED Talks and talk about all the great metrics, but they send their own kids to a Rudolf Steiner school or a Waldorf school and won't let them watch television. Mm-hmm. So it's a bit of a double standard there.
I wonder what that says. You know, they're taking their cue from Elon Musk, this idea of colonizing Mars, or Peter Thiel reversing the aging process, or Ray Kurzweil, who has been said to, you know, there's talk that he's uploading his mind into Google supercomputers or something of that nature. You know, I think one thing that they forget is this idea, let's say, about colonizing Mars. That's been tried here on Earth. It's called the biosphere.
Right. I know, exactly. Yeah, Steve Bannon, I think, was the CEO there, which is another all interesting conversation. But yeah, I mean, the idea that Elon's going to be able to get to Mars and build a bubble and somehow stay alive there, you know, if we couldn't do it with billions of dollars and a bunch of people and scientists here on Earth, it seems unlikely that they'll be able to do it on Mars in his lifetime. You know, there's really, I don't think that there is a viable escape route for humanity in the foreseeable future. You know, and I feel like the damage we're inflicting on the climate, on our own environment, is building faster than our ability to build
escape. Yeah, yeah. No, I hear you.
Escape program.
Well, you know, when you watch TV, you know, I know a lot of people like these zombie shows. I really can't even watch them for 2 seconds, but this post-apocalyptic view of things where people that are alive are no better than the undead, as you've written.
Yeah.
And even Westworld, the science fiction novel and show where robots run amok. In the second season, human beings, the ultimate reveal that the robots learn, they become smarter than us, but they really don't even want to be robots. They just want to be asleep in a computer somewhere. I mean, even that, any correlation to humanness is bad and something that nobody wants, even computers.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, you look at old sci-fi like Star Trek, and human beings are kind of the heroes of the universe.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, even with our flaws and our emotionality, you know, compared to the Vulcans, at least we were interesting and we had heart, and we would do the illogical, weird thing that would then beat the aliens. You know, and now human beings are the problem in any of these shows. Zombie shows, basically, yeah, they're about the fact that humans are no different from zombies. You know, we kill, they kill. It's the same. Or Westworld, that robots are better than us. And, you know, when I debate these folks, the folks that you mentioned who believe that, you know, we should upload our technology or our minds into the web or into the cloud, you know, I argue for the humans are weird. We're special. We're wonderful. There's things about us that we can't just isolate and get onto a CD-ROM just yet.
Yeah.
And they say to me, oh, Brushkov, you just say that because you're a human, like it's some form of hubris. And, you know, that's what got me writing. That's what got me writing the Team Human book. You know, it's almost a facetious idea, but yeah, I'm on Team Human.
Here's the problem. The problem is if we load ourselves up into the cloud, we're all going to forget our passwords. And we'll never...
Yeah. Well, once you're there, you only need the password to get back out.
We'll never get it back. We don't need the password anymore. Okay. You see, yeah. You have to be rational with me here. All right. So I want to go back to this idea. So after the event, these people want to figure out how they're going to be protected from the mass angry mobs. So they knew that armed guards would be required to protect their compounds. So they wanted to know, number one, how would they pay the guards once the money was worthless? How would they stop the guards from choosing their own leader? The billionaires considered using special combination locks on the food supply that only they knew, or making the guards wear disciplinary collars of some kind in return for their survival, or maybe building robots to serve as guards and workers if that technology could be developed in time. All of those seem incredibly flawed. What did you say to them?
I mean, I told them the best way to earn the loyalty of their security force in the future is to be really nice to them now. I mean, I made the joke. I said, well, why don't you, you know, pay for their kids' bar mitzvahs or something, you know?
Yeah.
Not that most of these special forces had, you know, bat mitzvah age daughters or anything. Mm. But my point was, you know, if you did pay for someone's kids' bar mitzvah, then 20 years from now, when they're in the bunker with you, they're going to see you as a friend, as someone who took care of them, as someone who was there. But none of these guys want to take care of these people. They look at even the security force as the other, as the masses, as, you know, the people on whom they're operating. And as long as you look like these technology type people do, as long as you look at people as like machines to operate, you're never going to connect with them. You're never going to really earn their true loyalty. And at that point, what's it even worth being in a bunker with a bunch of people who hate you?
Yeah. Wow. Interesting stuff. Douglas Rushkoff, professor of media theory and digital economics at CUNY Queens. The book is Team Human. The article was Survival of the Richest. The Wealthy Are Plotting to Leave Us Behind. Not if I have anything to do with it, Douglas. I'm telling you right now.
Excellent.
To hear this in any interview again, don't forget to come to our website, which is stevepomerantz.com, to join our conversation. While you're there, sign up for our weekly update, where we talk about all of our live events and any important topics we've covered that week straight into your inbox. That's stevepomerantz.com. Douglas, once again, thank you so much.
Thank you.